Light is all around us. From the morning's first rays of sun to the waning glow of a crescent moon. From the torches of our ancestors to the glowing screens of our mobile devices. Light is our guide, our timekeeper, and our guardian. Light shows us where to go and how to move. It teaches us how the world works and how to react. It helps us comprehend our reality. It lets us see. And there's nowhere where this is more apparent than when you're at a concert, listening to your favorite band, and the lighting designer is firing on all cylinders.
Okay, here we go. Episode 6 of the Lightside Podcast. This is going to be part 2 of my episode with the Fish Lighting Team. For those of you who did not check out part 1, definitely check that part out first. But if you're tuning in for the second half, man, there's a lot of good stuff in this one. Now, I will give you a warning. A couple things. First off, this episode definitely has a lot more technical jargon and that kind of thing in it. So if you're a casual listener, you're not really in the lighting industry, there may be a few things in here that confuse you, but I by all means, tune in, check it out. It's really cool. One other thing is that a lot of this episode actually happened during line check and sound check for the band. So some of it is, it gets a little hard to hear at times. I did the best that I could, but there's just so much good content and we didn't have time to re-record anything. So just bear with me and trying to understand what we're going through there at front of house. But before we get started, there are a few bits of news I'd like to share with you. Number one, I want to thank everybody who participated in emailing ACT and MA Lighting about the colored executor buttons. This is a feature I've wanted for years, literally years. And finally, in version 3.3.4.1, which just came out the other day, you can use the appearance keyword, which is assign, 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 to change the color of your executor buttons. It's just so awesome that finally you can make the green button turn the lights green, or the cyan button turn the lights cyan. So thank you for everybody who helped make that happen. It's a dream come true of mine. Number two, I'm happy to announce that we now have our own The Lightside Podcast Discord channel. For those of you who don't know, Discord is kind of like a new school chat room, IRC, AOL, Instant Messenger kind of chat thing. You can download the app for your phone, or you can just use it in browser on your computer. But to get to that, go to discord.lukestratdesigns.com. In the Discord chat, you'll see there's a bunch of channels, you know, one for each of the different kinds of consoles. So if you're an MA guy or a HOG guy or Camsys guy, you can go in there and chat with fellow users. There's a classified section for selling, buying gear, and finding gigs. There's also a share your work channel. So if you're an LD and you want to, you know, put up some pictures of your work or some videos of some recent designs, that's the place to do it. I set this thing up as a public place to talk about lighting. So if you're just a fan of lighting, if you're not actually in the industry, by all means, you're welcome to hop on over there and ask questions or you know, just join the general conversation. So again, that's discord.lukestratdesigns.com. Third, I have a new series I've started over on YouTube called Lighting Director's Commentary. So, you know, like DVD style, you can listen to the movie with commentary from the director. Well, I thought it'd be really cool to do the same kind of thing with lighting. And really, this comes from years and years of me watching other LDs work and just wondering, like, whoa, what's he thinking right now? What button is he pressing? Well, MK Devo and I, a good buddy of mine, we set up a camera at Higher Ground on a Dopapod show earlier in the year. And so it's a picture-in-picture, so on one picture you can see a small picture of the lighting rig, and then the bigger picture is actually over my shoulder of the console, and then I talk through what I'm doing for a specific Dopapod song. So I'm hoping this is the first of many videos in this series. I've already got a few LDs lined up to do the next couple ones. They take a little more time than a podcast episode to get out there, but man, how cool would it be to see, you know, your favorite designer talking about what he's doing cue to cue inside of a show. One last bit of news here. I've launched a Patreon page over at patreon.com/thelightside. Patreon is a service that lets creators, whether it be musicians or artists or podcasters, to get paid for their work. when I kicked this thing off, I had people be like, oh man, you could totally sell like ad space to like lighting vendors and manufacturers. And I was like, man, I don't want that. Like, First off, I don't want to pitch products that I don't believe in. And second off, if I was a listener, I'd hate having the episode interrupted. You know, I hate that. You're listening to a podcast, really into it, and then they're like, oh, by the way, like, have you heard about Dollar Shave Club? No, dude, this podcast is about the information. But, you know, it does cost some money for me. You know, I've got equipment that I bought, and I've got plane tickets that I'm hoping to buy for future podcasts that I can't hit up, you know, just while I'm on tour with another band. So if you like the show, if you get information out of it, maybe consider kicking me a buck or two or five per episode. That's how it works. Or not, you know, keep listening for free. I don't feel bad about that. I'm just, you know, if you are interested in this show going more places, let me know. Again, that's patreon.com/thelightside. Okay, so without further ado, here's part two of my episode with the Fish Lighting Team. Gif, I want to talk about your origin story. How did you get started? When did you know you wanted to get into lighting? What was like the beginning of you being a lighting manipulator, if you will?
I was in middle school, and I somehow snuck into the lighting control booth of the theater that was shared with the high school, mm-hmm. right? And really enjoyed playing with the console. I got myself in trouble because they were trying to have a dance class up there, and I shut a bunch of lights off on them. And then ended up designing the lights for that same dance show a couple of years later. So yeah. I knew in high school what I wanted to do, for sure. What I had a hard time finding was a place to go to school to study it, because I was always the math and science kid, mm-hmm. in high school, right? And I was fairly sure I wanted to get a degree in electrical engineering, mm-hmm. but I saw the potential for how that could be combined with my passion for lighting, and it took a while to find the university that would eventually let me do exactly what I wanted, and it turned out to be the Schreyer Honors College at Penn State. Mm-hmm. And Penn State has this advantage of being just a massive campus. There's multiple venues. There's always an opportunity to get involved with doing shows there, right? And then they let me study a combination of what I consider the relevant parts of electrical engineering, architectural lighting design, theatrical lighting design, and perceptual psychology, of all things.
Make your own major.
Yeah. And we wrapped it up into a major. I had to do a thesis that showed how all of that was interconnected in some way.
Is that like a paper or a project?
Both.
Yeah.
So I lit a play using nothing but projectors, right?
Oh,
and then
okay.
got really sort of deep into the science of what was being emitted from the projectors and how that was interacting with skin tones and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, then, of course, a couple of years later, the DL1s and all of that came out.
Yeah.
But
so what happened after college then?
Okay, so I had done a show in New York. Another great thing about Penn State is that it was very easy to get places. Like, it's basically 3 or 4 hours from Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, and New York, right? So I was here. I did a show with a friend of mine, Guy Smith, at Webster Hall. And the lighting designer on that show was Steve Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And this was shortly before I had graduated. And Steve Cohen, it turns out, was looking for an assistant in Las Vegas. And I got a phone call from Steve's partner, Curtis, just like a week before I graduated. And I was having that panic feeling of, oh,
yeah.
Okay, now what? What
yeah.
am I going to do with my life, right?
Yeah.
And
in
perfect timing, Curtis said, hey, we met you in New York. We would like to give you a shot working with us out here in Vegas. So I packed up like the day after I graduated and drove to
wow.
Las Vegas, and the rest is history.
That's job placement for you.
Yep. Yeah, it worked
yeah.
out well.
Yeah. What percentage of designing and programming, like what's the mix for you usually?
I would say there's a handful of gigs that I'm involved with just solely being the programmer.
Okay.
But usually I have a creative role
sure.
as well. Whether that's,
like in this gig.
Yeah, whether it's being the lighting designer or the associate. There are a handful of gigs where I'm strictly just programming.
Yeah.
But the majority of the projects that I work on, I have direct creative involvement with what it's going to look like. I definitely enjoy projects like this where I get to work in tandem with somebody like Chris because we exchange ideas and build upon ideas and we ping pong and bounce things back and forth.
Yeah.
In a situation where I have to be the designer and the programmer, I'm missing that other entity there, that other person, which is why I think the relationship that we have works so well.
Okay, how about Previz? Are you guys using 3D for most of your stuff?
Yeah, we use MA3D.
Do you ever go into WYSIWYG?
Nope.
All, just because of the level of integration.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the MA3D is actually essential to how the show operates now, not just for Previz, because we had to build all of the truss structure very accurately, I might add, in order for the tracking to work so that the lights can stay focused on the stage as the trusses move.
Yeah.
That all revolves around the MA3D model.
Okay. So can we dig into some of what Chris was talking about with the XYZ versus pan tilt and what you went through? What were some of your workarounds to pull that off?
So you understand the basic problem, right? Is when the trusses move there are certain lights that need to be focused at the stage, they're not anymore, right? So
am I clear in that if it's an aerial, it's not XYZ?
Correct. So it turns out that there's only one focus in the entire show that is using XYZ, and it's the band focus, right?
Okay.
Everything else is aerial graphics, and those all we actually very specifically.
Just an FYI here to the listeners, we're going into Fish's line check. So parts of this get kind of loud, kind of hard to hear, but I left it in because the content's so good. So just bear with us.
No, all the graphic positions intentionally are static pan and tilt, and it when the trusses move, we actually like seeing those beams move
with
the trusses. The tricky one, obviously, is the focus that's got to stay pointed at the band.
Yeah.
The challenge is, it's not just one set of lights that stay focused at the band. It could be any given set of lights at any given time, and it needs to be able to smoothly get to the stage from a graphic position or from the stage out to one of the graphic positions, right? So that's the bit, is the transition between a pan and tilt position and an XYZ position that definitely needs some more development on the MA end. But
so there's no like crossfade between the two?
There is. It's wildly unpredictable how it's going to work.
Is it because of the XYZ doesn't know which way the head is tilted when it does it?
That's part of the issue. The bigger problem is that when you're in an XYZ position, the console thinks about the transition from that to someplace else in terms of drawing a straight line through space, which I guess makes sense if you're trying to follow something that's like on the stage.
Yeah.
But that can create really unpredictable results when you're just trying to crossfade the lights out into the audience, right?
Sure, yeah.
So basically what we ended up doing was recording the entire show with nothing but pan and tilt presets. Everything in every cue is a pan and tilt preset. But the band focus also has an XYZ version, right? So with everything, with all the cues recorded as pan and tilt, all the transitions between the cues can be smooth because you just crossfade the pan, tilt, just like it's always worked, right? Then in the background, I'm constantly running a macro that is looking for any of the lights that are in the band pan and tilt position and replacing that temporarily with the XYZ version of it, right?
Got it, yeah.
So then as the trusses move, the lights stay focused on the stage, no problem. The issue is now you've got fixtures that are in XYZ mode, and they're now supposed to fly out over the audience. What happens, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you let the console handle the transition, it's wildly unpredictable.
Of course. But
the solution, and it took a lot of trial and error to finally get to this workaround, is a macro runs that touches the pan and the tilt attribute and then immediately releases them. This forces the console to get set up in the pan and tilt position mode, right? And then it'll do the transition smoothly, just like a crossfade.
So
can I take
a stab at this? So you've got them in an XYZ on the band.
Yep.
The macro runs, grabs those pan tilt values, restores it, and then fades from the new pan tilt value out?
Somewhat. So what happens is every cue in the console has a very small delay time on the position before it moves, right? That small delay time allows for a macro to run that is literally in the command line of every single cue in the show.
Yeah.
And that macro touches the pan and tilt attributes of any of the fixtures that are currently using an XYZ position. With the pan and tilt activated, it restores the pan and tilt version of the band focus, right, of the band preset, right, so that the next time the lights come back to that position, remember all the cues only have pan and tilt data in them, right? Mm-hmm. So the next time the lights come back to that position, unless the trusses have moved since then, they're going to come back to the right spot, right? So then immediately after it records the new, or should say updates the pan and tilt version of the band focus, it releases the pan and tilt attributes, but the position mode attribute has now been set to pan and tilt.
Got
so
it.
When the lights move to their graphic position, the crossfade is just smooth, regular old pan and tilt.
Sure.
It would be much, much cleaner if we could just record the XYZ position into the cues and have it do the transitions well.
Yeah.
Because there would be none of this, oh, wait, it's using the pan and tilt that corresponds to the last truss position, and then you've got to see them swoop in and whatever. Yeah. So. Definitely, room for improvement on the software development. But I should point out that the tracking itself works flawlessly. I mean, we've got the whole head flipping thing that other people have run into problems with under control. The PSN signal we get from Navigator accurately positions the truss in the 3D model, including, by the way, in this show. You know, we can go vertical with the trusses, so they're only hanging off of one point, right? Well, that when it's only hanging off of the one motor, it's not just a rotation of the truss in space, it's actually translating along the x-axis of the stage as well, because it's getting pulled to the direction of the one point that it's hanging off of. So Sam Hillier at Tate actually wrote some custom code in the Navigator system to account for that physics, and it's accurate within the PSN data that we're getting from Tate.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Okay. Here, look at this in the lighting visualizer.
So this is how we built all of the positions for the trusses, right?
Yeah.
They are stage markers in the MA. Or I should say, there are stage markers that has the truss and all of the lights that belong to that truss attached to it. Mm-hmm. And we are able to control the Z translation, the Y rotation, and interestingly enough, the X translation, because like we were talking about when the trusses are picked up by one point, they swing towards that direction. And we sat there and created these.
Yeah, we're looking at MA3D, and it's literally drawing. Right now we're looking at the sideways position where the whole rig is just sideways.
Yep. And so this was me, Chris, and Abigail Holmes all together in Previz just making what these shapes could be. And then we had to export them from the console as well as marry them to a screenshot of what it's supposed to look like for the Tate guys to reconstruct it in their world.
Wait, okay, so when you're pressing the button, it does something in 3D and obviously on the console, but it's not, you're still calling over the radio to change the rig.
Correct.
So you can't just sit there and jam new positions.
No, that's something we call to the automation.
Is there ever a possibility of sending like a MIDI command or an ARNET command to them?
We could, but the verbal communication seems to be working really well.
He's not to the point where it's like rig changing and ending on a downbeat.
No, and that would be really hard to implement just with those guys are back there monitoring the speed that everything's running at and whatever for safety with their spotters.
This is one of my favorites. It's like the rig rooftop. Almost looks like a pyramid. Can you show me the vertical position?
Yeah. We have very creative names for all of these things.
Yeah, that's so cool. It's like all the you cut half the cables and the rig is just hanging straight up and down.
Yeah. And now what's interesting is if I release this cue list that I'm bumping through of all these positions that we made. Now this is back to getting the real-time data from PSN, and when they move those trusses, they will follow in the visualizer exactly what they're doing in reality.
Oh, so you don't have to, it'll do it. You don't have to match commands.
Exactly.
So you don't have to be I'm going, okay,
no, great. So, and if they run something slower or faster or
or like in the middle of the effect, you don't have to be hoping that you're synced. It's actually
correct. Yeah. We're getting real-time accurate information. The technology is called PSN, Posi StageNet, from
awesome.
Navigator.
And how does that? Can I see that on? Is there anything to see? Like
there is. So
we're in the setup. We're going into
view tracker.
Oh yeah.
So,
okay. Yeah, they're called pods here.
Yeah, that's how the Tate guys had named them. But so there's 30 stage markers. They correspond to 30 stage marker fixtures mm-hmm. in the MA show file. Mm-hmm. And each one of them has an X, Y, and a Z position and an X, Y, and a Z rotation that we're getting from Tate. Now, not all of those axes apply to this particular setup with trusses, but that's the way PSN works in general. Okay.
And then how does that, can I see, if possible, how that goes into a queue?
I'm not sure.
Or like that, or you're just, how does this get translated into XYZ data? Or you just build the positions that way and it does it automatically?
Oh, you're talking about the focus positions.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what happens is we tell the lights where we want them to go on stage using X, Y, and Z coordinates, right? For example, the front light pointed at the guys, we center about, everything's in meters in the console, right? About 1 meter up from the ground, and then set the X and the Y position of where they stand on stage, mm-hmm. right? And then the console knows to keep the light focused in that direction at that particular point in space. As the trusses move, and that's the trick, is that the stage marker, which is being moved by this data from PSN, PSN, is also moving all those lighting fixtures with it.
So
in the
MA3D / the 3D engine in the console is actually redrawing the position.
Correct. It's keeping the light pointed at a specific point in space that we've set as that head is moving around with it.
Yeah, I've used this with the Z offset follow in stage view where you just click a point and all the lights go there.
Yeah.
But you guys have taken it all the way to the whole system.
Yep.
You know.
And kind of in a reverse fashion, I feel like how most people use this technology is usually you're trying to track an object or a person that's moving around on stage.
Totally.
Our guys stand in one spot for the most part.
Yeah.
We're dealing with the lighting fixtures themselves that are moving.
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah, perfect.
On the way upwards, the colors come back. But all along the bottom is blue, gray, and black. Darkness is cold, and perception goes wrong. And the night seems to go on incredibly long. So I ask you why.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how you guys hang the best boys, because when you first loaded the rig, you were telling me last year.
I was going to mention that earlier.
Yeah, so, can you talk about that?
The best boys are great because they allow us to put cue timing on the gobos, right? Which is great. Except the way that that particular fixture is engineered, it gives the appearance that the gobos are changing by moving left to right. Most fixtures tend to change them in the plane that looks like it's moving up and down, right?
Yeah.
And we realized that could be awkward if the entire rig was changing gobos and it looked like it was moving in one direction, left to right.
Sure.
So we literally asked Terry, our crew chief, to hang half of the best boys backwards. So all the even numbers have the tails go in the opposite direction as all the odd numbers. We flip the tilt in the console, and then the whole stage, when the gobos are changing, they sort of ooze into each other or ooze away from each other at adjacent lights rather than everything go in the same direction.
Yeah, after you told me this last year, I was like, that's a brilliant way to deal with it. So I had Roby points, but they don't have that problem, but they go up and down. But I just started flipping my ground package, so when I do a rain effect, the ground falls down instead of up. It works great. Yeah.
The other thing that ended up working out is Chris had mentioned we like the split colors we can get out of the color wheel on the icon edges.
Yeah.
So we hung half the edges backwards too, so that adjacent lights will have symmetrically opposite split colors.
Makes perfect sense to me. One of those things that you would never think to do unless you,
You should have seen Terry's face when we asked him to do it. He said,
Sure, no problem, but could I ask why?
Yeah. We want to make more work for you. Yeah.
No, he's so organized with how everything's labeled up there that just it's part of the information. It's like fixture type, fixture number, address, and tail direction.
Yeah.
And it's right there on the label.
Great. Well, can we dig into the file a little bit?
Sure.
I did want to talk. I know you're kind of a macro wizard, so I kind of want to talk about the last look macros. Are you still doing that?
Absolutely.
And the macro that you use to build basically a wipe from anything. Is that like blind edit, apply a delay time?
I know the one you're talking about, and it's actually a slightly different concept. That one we refer to as buttons off unwipe.
Okay.
Right? So there's a macro that's buttons off, right?
Yeah.
Gets you out of anything that you've punted over that base backbone look that we had talked about, right?
Sure.
And one day, Chris looked at me, this was a couple of years ago, right? And said, wouldn't it be great if we could do the buttons off as a wipe across the stage, because there's so many wipes in other places in the show.
Yeah.
I looked at him, I said, you got to be kidding me. But took on the challenge, right?
Yeah, sure.
And it's actually not that complicated. It's when he hits that macro in a show, the console knows what look number is active at any given moment. There's a variable that gets set every time you run a new look, right? Mm-hmm. And it basically just re-records that look with delay timing on all the attributes, and then fires it, and then when it's done, puts back the standard 5-second crossfade on it.
Yep.
So all the attributes, I should say, of every fixture are in every look, specifically so that, like, if you pop a gobo in with a punt button, the look has the gobo recorded as open, so that then when you run that trick, it'll open up the gobo again wipe timing.
So when you showed it to me, I was just assuming it was wipe any look. But it also builds in, because of the way the file's built, it also wipes off anything else that's running. Beautiful. I love it.
So if I have a dimmer effect going, for example, all right, so I have a look up, and I change a color, and I pop the gobo out, and I rise it up in the air, and I run a dimmer effect. When I hit the buttons off unwipe, it unwipes all those attributes in wipe form. So the dimmer chase stops running.
Oh, that's beautiful. So it's on the effect layer too. Then,
and it goes to the position that it originally, if it was swept. And the gobos pop back in. And the original colors back in.
Got it.
All that stuff. So you can take a look, go wherever you want with it, do whatever you want to it. And when you restore it, it restores in wipe form.
Got
Where it used to be buttons off would just turn off any buttons I had triggered. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing would just go whoomp all at once. So again, in the mantra of elegant, we wanted an elegant way to do it.
Do you have any other like cool tricks like that in the file? I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch, but
Well, we can start with that last looks thing that you were talking about,
right? This is a really cool feature. Yeah.
So I told you there's a variable that gets set every time a cue is run that just refers to that cue number, right?
Yes.
There also, I think we decided on 5. Yeah, there are 5 tiles right in front of Chris that will show the numbers of the last 5 looks that he has run. And it allows you to sort of ad hoc make a song structure, right?
You're in a chorus bridge.
Right. What look did I use for the chorus? Oh, wait, that was 2 cues ago, and you go over to the second tile there, and right now it's a 61, and if you press that button, it'll
go to 61,
with 5 seconds? With 5 seconds.
Of course. Wait, so how often do you use that?
All the time.
Like, all 5 of them, or, like, are you always using number 2?
No, all 5 of them.
Nice.
Like, I wanna, what did I use 4 cues ago? It comes in very handy.
That's very cool, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's another one. When you showed it to me last year, I was like, oh, I got to do that. And I spent all, I like, okay, this macro rewrites these macros, and then I never use it.
Oh,
like,
really?
It's just not my style, yeah.
Huh.
I mean, I use the looks again, but I have, like, all my looks are named after mostly science fiction planets.
That's funny.
So I'll just remember, like, oh, I need to go from Bespin to Alderaan. Like, I just go back.
Oh, ours don't have names, just numbers. But names would be a useful mnemonic.
I spent a lot of time on them, actually.
Well, what we're talking about, these macros and things, I think one of the things about fish is that all of these are born out of some sort of necessity, right? Yeah. It's not like we sit around and go, what sort of clever macro or Lewis script or can I come up with just because, right? Yeah. No, it always comes out of a conversation where it's like, wouldn't it be great if this, and then we sit down and figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Right. You guys usually get a lot of work done during this time of day?
When we need to.
Yeah, but you're pretty dialed in at this point?
At this point, yeah.
Do you have days where you're like, let's go crazy, I got a new idea?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And one of the really great things about using MA3D is because it's integrated into the MA network, you can work in blind and the visualizer will follow you there. So a lot of times, the idea will come, or an idea will come during a show even, right?
Yeah.
And if I have the time while Chris is running the show, I'll be sitting here at the other console with the visualizer open, working on a new idea, or fixing something that didn't work. But you can do that in blind.
Got it.
Yeah.
That's a nightly occurrence. I'll run some cues and go, you know, I need this cue to work this way also.
Great. Do you have an example of what kind of edit you might want to make?
Yeah, for example, like the atoms, the atom wipe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had just built it to wipe in our usual 1.2 second wipe time.
Yeah.
But then I realized that I was in a moment in a song where I needed it to wipe at 5 seconds or 10 seconds or slow it down, which I have speeds. These button. Yep.
Yeah, and those are just. Am I correct? Those are just macros underneath that change the fader.
Correct. They have a channel that's in there that's linked to a DMX remote.
Got it.
In the consoles. Yeah. And it's moving a speed fader or a rate fader on another
page. So you click 5 seconds, but the console thinks, put that rate fader at 1.48.
Or whatever.
Or that particular cue is not written to talk to those times.
Okay, got it.
So then I'll find myself in a moment and turn to him and go, hey, I need this cue to talk to those
times. Got it. I got it. Okay.
He'll put his head down and do what he does. And
that happens in the show. That's not like a sound check thing.
Live.
Awesome.
Things like that. That's a nightly occurrence.
Or something's running and you need to be offed.
That happens. Yeah. Or sometimes it's quite simply like, I need the floor lights out in this queue so that I can see the floaty truss move better.
Got it.
Things like that.
Got it, yeah. Okay, so I guess, can we go maybe through the faders and then through the buttons real quick? Because that's kind of like what everyone always wants to know.
What are you
doing with the fingers, you know? Okay, yeah, let's start with the X keys. And these don't change during the show, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
These are the go-to muscle memory from back in Grand Ame 1 days. The hard keys start with a button that the first time you hit it runs the color wheel slowly. Second is a faster color scroll.
Some people might call it like a rainbow effect.
But it's specifically just the color wheel and the fixtures. And you can toggle between the slow and the fast version of it for a very specific effect. The next two are one-shots of every single fixture type. That's turning on, turning white if it was already on, stopping whatever else it was doing, like strobing or rotating a gobo or whatever, and with timing that goes from stage right to stage left, and then the button that's next to it goes from stage left to stage right and does the same thing.
Got it.
That's for all fixture types. Now, up on the touchscreen, we have them split up into individual fixture types if you only want to do that same gag with the Best Boys, let's
say. So that's wiping and off? But what does it wipe? Oh, white on, open, all the way through the rig.
Correct.
Got it, yeah.
The next two are those
the off
buttons off unwipe that we were talking about. There's a stage right to stage left version and a center stage to off stage version.
Mm-hmm.
The next five are color changes for everything except the BIs. The BIs are sort of their own world. They're the park hands, as Chris had described it, right? They're go buttons that change the color of the entire rig. There are more of those on the multi-touch screen. The most commonly used ones are here on hard keys.
Yeah.
Blue, magenta, red, yellow,
so
and
they
white.
Just take the park hands to a specific color.
No, everything but the BIs, which are the park hands, right?
So we're here on X11, we've got a
stack of strobes. The first cue is unison fast, then there's an offset fast, then there's an offset slow, and then the last cue is a unison medium. the notice I said offset and not random. So we don't use the random strobe function of any of the fixtures.
No,
instead,
of course not, yeah.
If you look up at any one fixture when we're in one of these offset cues, you'll notice that that fixture is actually strobing at a constant rate. But we shuffle the selection order and then make that rate slightly different across the entire rig.
Yeah,
so the whole rig, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just a.
So how does he off that if it's just a go?
So at the other end here, X20 is open strobe, and notice that's exactly the width of a human hand, right?
So
you can sort of toggle between.
None of them are hold to go. They're it strobes and then he offs it with X20.
Correct.
Got it.
In fact, almost everything in this show is set up that way. There's very few things that are just a temporary flash.
I was watching the other day, and he had the rainbow thing going, the color wheel, and he wasn't touching anything. And I was like, I would never do that. If it's strobing, I'm holding it down, you know? Yeah. I love it, though. Okay, and then what's next? Pause, X12.
Okay, so these are used heavily in the show. They're similar, but different. They're called pause effects and stop effects, right? So pause does literally that. If, let's say, a dimmer chase is running is a simple example, right? And you hit pause. What it's really doing is jamming down the rate faders that are on another page to zero so that the effect that's running will stop right where, it is, right?
This is like when a BI is doing a wipe thing and it stops in the middle and starts again.
Exactly. That's a pause, and that's a momentary button. Yeah. When you let go, it restores to what it was doing.
Okay,
right?
Gotcha.
The adjacent button is called stop effects, which is a different concept. That's actually got stomp values for most of the attributes of the fixtures in there. So if you're running a dimmer chase and then you hit that button, instead of the dimmer chase pausing where it was, the dimmer values from the underlying look come back, and it just restores the look as it was without the chase running.
Got it. Okay, and then we got an empty hole, which I can't believe.
It will be filled before we leave the garden.
I'm sure.
The regular old just shut off anything that you've punted over the look button.
So the looks is really like the core. It's the backbone of this show.
It is.
Yeah, got it. And then X16?
Opens the gobo on anything. The next button is that constructed ballyhoo that I was describing earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's really just the lights moving between three different positions and three different groups.
Yep.
Then there's a cue stack we call ends. The ends are the cues that usually, as the name would imply, are used at the end of a song in a really chaotic moment.
Like a ballyhoo with strobing?
Color effects, dimmer effects, all baked into the one cue, so you don't have to go poking at five different things to get to your big build-up moment. You can just run, go straight to Q3. 1, 2, 3, and you'll get what we call N3.
Does that off with the off here?
It offs with the off buttons.
Yeah. Oh, okay, got it, yeah. And then X19, which is labeled Roy G. Viv.
Yep, that's the big old color chase.
Okay, that's the one I'm used to seeing where it's kind of a wiped-in rainbow effect.
Exactly, it's like a center-out pattern, but it goes very, very, very fast.
Yeah, you kind of have to be paying attention and to see it come on.
It's not an effects engine thing. It's literally Roy G. Biv.
Just a fast stack that's wiping.
Yep.
Got it.
With
a photo of it, it's like, oh, that's not a CMY effect. It's definitely, it looks good every time you take a photo of it.
Awesome.
Good work. Yeah. And then the off button, X20.
That opens the strobe. That's what I was talking about. So if you're thumb is on the strobe stack, your pinky is on the open strobe button.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So then moving over, what do we got on our 101 buttons across the console?
Most of them are doing something similar or identical to what the button for the fader is doing right on top of it, right? And this comes back from Chris's muscle memory, basically, right?
Okay.
So there are subtle differences, though. Each one of these looks has all sorts of things built into the background. Fixtures that don't necessarily have their intensity on in the look are setting up in colors, for example. Or in the case of the BIs, different shapes that we've made out of the pixels, right?
So you're saying that the shape might be ready, but not actually playing on the effect.
So that what you're seeing right there, that arrangement of pixels in the BI and those colors, right, are baked into the look. And when I flash this button, it maintains the shape that's in there, right?
Yeah.
If you flash the button on top of it, like I was just hitting 123, if I hit 23, it takes the shape out.
Got it. See? Okay. Yeah. And so in the look stack, you have actually, we're saying shapes, but these are like pixel patterns on the BIs.
Correct.
For our listeners. Correct. Yeah. So they're built into the look, but you can either choose to use them or not.
Exactly.
We also, I don't know if you mentioned, you know, we only use the first three rings of the BI most of the time.
Okay. Yeah, so Chris is saying they only use the first three rings of the BI most of the time.
Yeah, we found that that is a cleaner look than that gigantic head, right, when they're just being parked.
By first three, you mean the inside three?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the inside three rings.
Yeah, gotcha. So it looks like a smaller light than it actually is. And then only in like a weird, crazy effect will you use the fourth ring?
Correct.
Got it.
We just found that to look a lot cleaner than the big.
Sure. Sure. And then do you have stuff that switches the downstage BIs in and out of an effect that you have going?
Yeah. I mean, all that pixel shit.
Yeah. Right? Well, that plays through all of the BIs, though. The only example I can think of that's similar to what you're talking about is there's a button that will rise all of the BIs out over the audience, but not take the downstage ones with it.
Okay.
So that they stay on the band.
But for most of the show, they all behave together.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Okay, so then across the console, you've got a bunch. Are most of those the BI Parcan looks we were talking about earlier?
The faders, yes.
Yes. And then you've got specials for each band member, which
correct.
You would call Licos, and if they used to be Licos, yeah. That's what I would call them, you know?
Yep.
And then you've got some, is it Grandmasters and faders for each different fixture type?
Right, so the intensity for everything, with the exception of the BIs, which are treated like Parcans most of the time.
Yes.
The intensity for everything comes from the look, right?
Yeah.
And some looks have all of a certain fixture type on. Some looks don't. You know, they're more sparse. So rather than having faders that bring the intensity up for lights, these are inhibitives that just bring it down when you don't want it. But when you turn it, or when you throw the fader all the way up, you get the dimmer arrangement that comes from
the look. Yeah.
The look.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, and then, you know, we don't have to go through every sequence, but what's the general vibe of the top three screens as far as touch goes?
All right, so let's start over here on the left. So the first couple of rows up here are BI-specific stuff.
Yep.
Color effects, dimmer effects, they can play over top of each other. That's a common theme in this show, is being able to layer
things. Yeah.
In fact,
That's the and.
It's the and.
Yeah.
I get a big smile sometimes during a show when Chris has layered a couple of things together that we never conceived would be layered together when we wrote it in the first place, but it ends up being perfect for whatever moment that is. You just go, wow. Then there's a small chunk of stuff here that's specific effects for the house rig here in the garden.
Sure. Some like kind of pan tilt stuff or
exactly.
color wheel stuff.
Exactly. Although most of the color information for the house rig comes from the looks and wipes and sprinkles and everything else, because it all plays together.
Sure.
Right.
Question on the house rig. When you're using the wash just to light the seats, is that a donut thing? Or just another?
It was a donut thing during Harpua.
Yeah. Okay. Because I didn't realize till I was in a different spot. When I'm down here, I'm like, you don't see that. But up there, you're like, oh, it's a donut. Yeah. It's a big theme this week.
Well, sort of back to what we were talking about before, about creating things on the fly. You know, the original clone just cloned the garden system to our system. So I'd run a one shot on the stage and get the one shot playing in the garden because of the clone. But realized that I needed to just be able to one-shot the garden rig only.
Yeah.
So then I could turn the GIF and go, I need that.
Like
in 30 seconds. And he'll go, no problem, and write me a new cue and plop it in an empty space and go, here you go.
So 30 seconds, is that you just write a new cue, or do you copy one you haven't put a world filter? Like, what's your method?
In that case, I just copy the sequence and remove all the other stuff
from it. Yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah, that's cool that you guys have that level of, like, you know what you want, you can get it happening so that it'll work well enough at showtime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or like Chris was saying, during the show,
happens. During the show, yeah. Because, like, I do that sometimes, but, like, if I'm going to do it during the show, there's a risk that, you know,
right.
I still have to run the show, you know? So, okay, so then I guess on the screen, 1, 2, 3 here.
Well,
the middle screen.
We missed something on the first screen, which is the bottom couple of rows are all effects for the X4 atoms that are in the trusses.
Oh, okay.
Lots of different one-shot
the
type
truss
stuff.
Accents, as we've been saying.
Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, those have been really cool.
Some of them are made with specific truss configurations in mind. There's one in particular when the trusses are in this position we call basket weave, right? Mm-hmm. That the effect starts at one corner of the rig zigzags through the shape and then bounces back the other way when it gets to the other end.
I had that on my notes.
Yeah.
You kind of know when you're on my world, you know, always program all the time. Whenever there's something new on the rig, I'm like, oh, now that's new. I like seeing that, you know.
And it works with pause effects. If we play, you pause it, it'll stop it. It almost looks like Tinkerbell.
Yeah. It's
cool. Like,
yeah, totally.
And we are very aware of our audience and how many of them come to many shows. So that's something we're always striving to do, is to be adding new tricks in the arsenal to give something, give people something new to look at.
Yeah. Now, I guess while we're talking about the moving rig, I saw a post you had on one of the forums. Does the layout view change when the rig changes?
You know what that idea came from was for the New Year's gag that we did last year. Do you remember the...
Is it the umbrellas?
The umbrellas,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
We were thinking about using the bitmap engine in the console to run the lights on the umbrellas, but the umbrellas track through space up and down, and it would have been great to map it that way. We ended up not doing that.
Yeah.
And no, the fixtures don't move in the layout view when the trusses move. They do move in 3D and the stage view, obviously.
Okay, so on to the second screen, which we would call screen 3 in MA terms.
That's right. Most of this screen is occupied by dimmer effects. The bottom row is all of the fixture types doing a particular dimmer effect. And then as you go up the screen, you know, one button higher from the all button is just the best boys doing that particular dimmer effect. One button higher than that is just the edges doing that particular dimmer effect.
You got it. Okay.
The top row is interesting.
So the top row changes the color of the atoms, right? Mm-hmm. So there are moments where, and again, every look has a base color for the atoms baked into it, right?
Yep.
But in the moment where Chris wants to change the color, he can hit one of these buttons, and I think we've got 10 of them here, 10 different colors, there you go. But the next button to the right of all of that sets the mode that all of these buttons work in, and that's either it snaps to that color, it crossfades to that color, it wipes to that color, it sprinkles to that color, etc. So that's a good example of maximizing real estate on the console. Rather than taking up 50 buttons to do that, it takes up 10 plus the one more that sets up the mode.
Got it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
This one in the top right corner is another interesting one. We jokingly labeled it loopy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure we were a little loopy when we were conceiving it. And what it does is anything in the show that is just a one shot that just plays once across the stage, right? If this cue is engaged here, it changes the behavior of all those other buttons so that instead of just playing once, a fraction of a second before it's done, it re-triggers itself and plays continuously.
Okay, so I have to ask how that works, because that's pretty cool.
Okay, so each one of the cues that would potentially want to do that, if you look in the command field on the cue,
it's
checking a variable. It's saying if loopy is set to on right now, then top the executor, and then it refers to itself by name.
Got it.
And there you go.
So when one button's on, the command line turns on in all these other cues, and that command line just loops when it gets to that cue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it comes in handy when you need three hands.
Sure.
You don't want to keep hitting that.
Like, if you want it, you're playing it to a thing. Else, yeah. Right. Yeah. You want it to feel musical. Yeah.
Something that Chris likes to do a lot is set that and then run one thing, start it looping, and he's got his finger ready on the next thing that he wants to layer on top of it, and he waits until the first thing is at exactly the right place in its cycle and then runs the next thing. So now you've
both
got
looping.
You've got them looping on top
of
each other.
It's almost like how a new school DJ would bring in new sounds, you know?
Sure. That's an accurate comparison.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And then below loopy,
This looks like a bunch of gobo wipes and stuff.
Yeah, these are wipes. These ones specifically are fun. They black out the entire rig in wipe form. And then all of these different things. Anything that you can get into with these buttons, you can also get out of by running the next cue. And that's not as simple as making the button a toggle that just shuts itself off, then you wouldn't get the wipe timing, for example.
So but you're wiping a release in there?
Yeah. So these things that black out the whole rig, you can run it, the rig is blacking out, and then the next cue that you run, which is Q99, just a convention we set up, that's always the release in every one of these things, right?
Okay.
In the same wipe timing, in the same order, will wipe the dimmer information back in, in the form of releasing it in the cue.
Okay,
right?
So I think I saw this last night where you've got end of a song, you wipe it out, and then do you just black everything out and then release the wipe? Got it.
Exactly right.
And the other thing you can do with all of these is run the release before the first cue is actually completed, right? So you end up making little bands that run across the stage, right?
Yeah, totally. Because you can just sit there and jam it.
Exactly.
That's very musical.
When we conceived all these things, that was a very important aspect to be able to do that.
Yeah, just to be able
to be able to run it while the second part of it while the first part is still going, you know?
Sure.
One of our favorite tricks that actually has hard keys because it's so versatile wipes out the dimmer information on the BIs, right? So it's telling all the pixels of the BIs to be at zero.
Got it.
In wipe form. And then you can press it again to wipe everything back in. But in one of our famous and moments, we added another layer to that, which is the line of pixels that's about to be wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
Turns white for a fraction of a second right before the dimmer goes out behind it. Yeah, so it's got this sort of white leader.
So it looks like a white line is wiping everything in or out, right?
Yeah. So you have a bunch of delay time presets made so that you don't have to
The trick is, one of the first things I do once the design of the rig is established every year is I make six buttons. It's the entire, or six presets, I should say. It's the entire rig wiping in 1 second from right to left, the entire rig from left to right, top to bottom, bottom to top, center out, and out center. Okay? Then with those six things, 1 second each, it's real easy to select some fixtures.
Pick the wipe.
Pick that preset, but maybe it's supposed to be 1.6 seconds, not one. In the calculator pop-up, you can do math in there, right?
Sure,
so you just do times 1.6, and there you go. If you want it to be a half a second, you just do times 0.5.
So do you not? You don't have the wipes on, like, assigned to rate faders? So it's 1 second, but the rate fader is down at 0.5?
That's how this works over here. This is how you can control the speed of the wipes, right? When you hit the button for 3.2, we just calculated the math of whatever that rate fader has
to
be set up.
When you're building a hard wipe, you could be like, multiply by 5, and it's a nice long wipe. Okay, so what about here on 2, which is the top right screen?
That's all the whole rig wipes and sprinkles. It has override buttons for the colors of the flares, the strobe blinder fixtures, so...
Oh, okay, so this is what, like, replaced the Atomics.
Exactly.
What's the name of that fixture?
It's a Solaris Flare.
Solaris, and it's got some pixels on it, too, right?
It does.
Yeah. And you must love that, though, that the look can update the blinder color, the strobe color.
So, like you said, every look has a baked-in blinder color.
Yeah.
But if I don't want that color, I can select a new color that'll override
Sure.
Right.
Nice. Yeah, that's great.
But, again, it's a safety thing. Every look has that color baked
just in case,
in, so whatever I need to, if I don't have time to think to go over there and choose a color, when I flash them, it'll be a color that goes well with the look that's currently active.
Got it.
Some of these wipes on this screen are two colors, and for example, in say lime and lavender, right? The best boys will be lime and the edges will be lavender. But then the trick is there's a second cue that does the inverse of that, right?
So you can jam
And of course the cue stack loops on itself, right?
Yeah, gotcha.
Gotcha. It looks like one color is replacing the other as it moves across the stage.
Okay, so It seems like mostly it's laid out in chunks. It's not like too complicated. The faders are mostly the BIs and your master controls and specials, and then each chunk of the screen controls a different kind of thing. How do you get in and out of Q-Sacs from here?
There's a row of macros here that have the names of all the songs.
I can see them all right there. So if they play one of those songs, you're there.
Chris hits the button. That's the one situation where the look stack is not the thing that's selected.
So you can use the big go button.
So you use the big go button. Okay. Exactly.
Now, I did want to ask, I see Vocal Jam on here. How many toys are in there?
Well, Vocal Jam basically, go ahead and push it, right?
Yeah.
It now puts those faders in front of me.
And they do different things, right? So now we have the sphere scans, which of course...
Got it.
We haven't had a chance to use them in a Vocal Jam yet this year, but...
Yeah.
Can only assume one is coming.
Yeah, I would hope. Hopefully tonight while I'm here, right? I mean, that's kind of like... how much fun is that part of the show for you? Because it kind of feels like that's the one light solo that you get to take. You know
what the honest answer?
Yeah, I do.
It's torture.
Really? Yeah. Why?
Because it's, I don't know, it's just not my favorite thing.
Oh, the pressure's on you, yeah, and it's got to be cool. And
that kind of thing, and sure, all of that.
Sure, yeah.
As soon as they start Yem, I always look at Giff and go, oh.
Really? Interesting. It's interesting. I mean, it is cool that there is a chunk. So basically, they press this macro, and I'd say 10 faders changed. And that's kind of your area to play around, yeah.
It's actually less of a nightmare to run now. A few years ago, the way Chris did it was literally grab a group of lights and use the encoders to make the pan and tilt move around, right?
Yeah.
So we tried to come up with a little cleaner solution, sure. And now these are a bunch of temp faders that move lights between preset positions everything all the way stage left, everything all the way
anything
stage right.
From controlling the zoom of a fixture to pan and tilt to from one specific preset pan and tilt to another one,
yeah,
or just random movement moves the tilt, moves the pan. And there's a few different options. And,
yeah. It's interesting that you hate it. I love that. I love that piece of trivia, I should say.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
By the way, in all your questions, you never asked me favorite lighting cue.
Oh, yeah. What's the favorite lighting cue?
Buttons off on white.
Yeah, that's a great cue. Yeah.
By far the most badass cue.
It's definitely pretty sweet. Favorite cue.
Although he wrote me a new one, which I've really been digging, which is if the hybrid light is not in beam mode, in white form, put it in beam mode.
Nice.
And is that just that, a bottom to top and a side to side?
That's just a gobo that goes in?
It basically takes the edge.
And zooms it all the way small.
Pops the gobo out and slams it into Sharpie.
Got it. And that's like a high priority thing, so it stays there until... Oh, if you put a look that doesn't have it, it goes away.
Exactly. The looks intentionally will reassert themselves.
So shortly after this point of the interview, the band actually took to stage to start their actual sound check. So we called it a day as far as my interview with Chris is concerned. But up next, I've got my interview with lighting crew chief Terry Smith. Okay, so we're backstage now with Terry Smith, which is Fish's lighting crew chief. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Yep, and Giff is with us too. And I wanted to ask some questions just about this monstrosity that is the Baker's Dozen Fish rig. A lot of moving parts. But I guess let's start at the beginning. How did you end up working for Fish?
Working for Fish in the very beginning, by total accident.
Yeah.
So I was touring with Upstaging at the time. They called me and asked me about a range of dates. And I would miss the first day of that whole range, and so they said, "Oh well, we can't do this One Direction world tour."
Yeah,
and that was okay. The next week, they called me and gave me another range of dates, which I was available for, and that was Fish.
Great. So you were sent out with the vendor.
That's correct.
Yeah,
yeah. And even still, I belong to the lights.
Okay, great.
So if hypothetically they changed vendors, you would unfortunately go away.
I was about to say.
And has happened.
Yeah. Yes, okay.
We've been able to maintain Terry even as the vendor has changed, which is great.
Okay,
nice. So yeah, I was with Upstaging at the time, you know, and everything was great. It fit in my schedule. When Fish decided to move to PRG, then I think GIF was my first contact. Mm-hmm. And then I spoke to Chris and ultimately the production manager, you know, gauging everyone's level of interest in having me come along with them, because it, you know, it made so much sense on the rest of my life.
And that was coming on as a tech or as crew chief?
Yeah. So I had been crew chief the previous year
Upstaging.
That had been my first year.
So for those not familiar with the industry, what are all the responsibilities that a lighting crew chief has?
Wide and varying. So, I mean, when you're talking about the physical rig, you know, I essentially engineer the system, you know, based on the...
We give them a very crude drawing that says where the lights and trusses should go and what we'd like to call them in terms of fixture numbers, mm-hmm. and he figures out the rest.
Okay.
Right.
So you're like the... Like you said, the engineer behind making it actually
essentially,
work.
Yeah. Like Giff said, you know, it's a wide brush. You know, they say where the lights are, where the trusses...
So this is everything from the electrics and power for the whole rig.
Electrics, power distribution, data distribution. Mm-hmm. GIF actually has a fair amount to say in that. I mean, he designs it in such a way that it can be built practically.
Sure.
You know.
So you're thinking about the whole process. You don't just hand him something that's impossible. Like, here, make this work.
Occasionally we do, and then he has to tell us that it's impossible, and then we have to figure out a solution.
Okay, so let's talk about this specific rig, because it's very unique, if you will. Is it a wench system? Is that the right term?
So these are on nav hoists. Mm-hmm. So they're chain motors with encoders, essentially, and that's all operated by Tate. That's their domain.
Okay. Is that a company?
Yeah, Tate Towers.
Tate Towers, okay.
That's right. So
it's like a motor in one truss that's attached to...
That's correct. So we have five main mother grid pieces of truss that run across, and each one of those... has up to, well, there's 60 total motors, navigation motors. So, and each one of the sub trusses hung underneath it is hanging from two of those motors. And so now there are 30 individual trusses that can articulate in any pattern that you can imagine, you know, in any path that you can imagine, really. Yeah. And honestly, that's where, you know, like the real magic happens in that rig, is how it's manipulated. Building a kinetic sculpture essentially every day, you know, there's a little more engineering that goes into it.
It's cable management specifically that's difficult.
There's
right?
a considerable amount of cable management.
Yeah, it was
just
because
you know, the light has, or the truss has to be able to be anywhere vertically and also at any angle. So
the only control that you guys have is up and down per motor, right? There's no any swaying that we see in the audience is a byproduct of the truss moving, right?
That's correct.
There's not like a motor up there that says, hey, sway left or right.
Well, there are algorithms that kind of say, hey, left and right. You know, they pick up and drop a little bit.
Okay.
We've actually spent a considerable amount of effort in trying to make things not sway when we don't want them to. And even indoors, without factoring in wind or anything, you still have this problem of it's a dynamic load that's moving, right?
So, yeah.
And the fixtures themselves pan and tilt, swing around and
move. The
heads
move, yeah.
So there's a device called a light lock that Terry's got strapped to the top of every one of those trusses that's... basically got a smart gyroscope inside of it that's using rotational inertia to try to keep the truss stable.
Wow. Yeah. Wait, so that's in the hanging truss?
Yeah, it's on each individual piece of truss
that
moves.
How does that communicate with the motors?
So it's completely dumb. The light lock is completely dumb. It sits on the truss, and when the truss tries to twist itself...
it's got a counterweight
in
it.
Then it says stop.
Yeah. And you just send 110 to it or something?
This is 208. It just needs straight power.
As long as it's on, it knows to, like, balance itself out.
Exactly.
Awesome. Yeah, it's dumb in the sense that you don't control it, but it's actually kind of smart internally, right? There's an accelerometer or something in there that's...
It knows as it's, you know, twisting, it's got essentially two discs. Although we've not been inside of one yet, but it's got two discs that rotate opposite each other.
So there's
and keeps the truss from swaying, and just one of those will keep, you know, a 10-foot stick, or put a 10-foot stick back in, you know, back where it's supposed to be.
Nice. So there's like 24 of those up there or something.
30.
30. So 30 pods, if you will.
That's correct. There are 30 pods.
So what do you guys call them?
On five trusses, they're just trusses. They have alphanumeric names.
Okay, so let's talk about the process. Like, you get the plot from GIF,
What's the first step?
So I get the plot generally from two places. So I'll see a plot from GIF. That's, you know, like the proper paper plot that deals with all of the things lighting. Mm-hmm. And then I'll also get a plot from the stage manager who's been integrating, or not stage manager, excuse me, production manager.
Sure.
Who's been integrating from all the other departments.
With so audio now, and if there's any video exactly. or whatnot.
Video and motor specifically.
Sure.
Because it's all the same motor package.
Okay.
It's all the same steel.
Yeah.
You know, it comes from one place. So he, you know, I've got that information from him. And so then I combine all of that information and then put my automated system in on top of that. And then ultimately end up with a list of equipment that I need to build it and a roadmap to get there.
And like a half truck worth of cable, right? I mean,
sure. I mean, lighting is two trucks and change, and that's not including the mother grid or any of the other stuff. It's just pure lighting stuff.
So do you know how many universes this rig is?
It's 40?
39.
Okay. I take it that's
number 40.
Way higher because of the BIs, right?
Yeah, the BIs are
how many
near half a universe just on their own.
169 channels each. What we decided to do though was do one universe per truss to keep it simple. So out of those 30 pods, so to speak, that are hanging up there, even if the lighting fixtures on one of them don't really occupy an entire universe, there's one universe that's dedicated to each one of the trusses.
So is there like a NPU on stage? Like what's doing the actual output of the data?
PRG supernodes. The NPUs are in front of house with us for parameter expansion.
Sure. So is that streaming ACN?
Yep.
So everything comes out of data from front of house, like Ethernet?
Fiber
to distribution node center?
Yep. That's right.
And back then you're running analog data up to the rig?
Correct.
One cable per truss?
Pretty much. Well, I run a six-way cable data multi up to each mother grid, and then from there we break out.
Okay, so you don't have one. There's not 30 cables going up.
No,
there's 30 cables divided by six going up.
Correct.
And then So I was wondering. It was like almost like you needed an opto up on each one or something. But if it's a universe,
it's a universe per, right? Then, so I have to exactly.
Great. Okay.
And PRG has six way breakouts for their data, which is perfect for our purposes.
Just an analog, kind of like a multi pin.
Yeah. Exactly.
Got it. Okay. And then how much power does the rig need?
We're on two 400 amp services. We're a little over half on both services.
Okay. And then, like, are there problems? I don't really know if anything's coming up with this rig, but for the shows before this, like, did you have to change anything to fit it in certain rooms, or were there weight problems?
The mother grid, we've moved motors around on a daily basis, just to be able to catch dead hangs. And we keep enough motors on it that we're able to move it around, safely.
Yeah.
And so the weight's distributed.
When you say catch dead hangs for our layman listeners.
Sure. So this show is all about trim, right? And I've got a mother grid and another set of trusses down below it. So my goal is to get everything as close to the ceiling as I can.
Yeah,
pretty
trim
much every
being
day.
The top of the room, if you will. Yeah.
That's
where
especially
the motors can be, where the lights end up.
Right.
So in a room like this, there's a shell over the ceiling, so there are only certain places where you can really go straight to the steel. And if you have to bridle, right, then you've got, two angled bridles coming down and attaching to the chain, so you get down further than you want to be.
So basically, bridle, you mean you have two wires coming from two different pieces of steel to make a new point where you need it.
Where you attach the actual motor. Right.
Yeah, okay. And so then what are there, five motors per master grid?
There are five here. We actually have six on the two downstage for that specific reason. We added one so we could distribute the load and catch dead hangs. And
gotcha. Yeah.
And be able to get
so
it up to trim.
So when you say catch a dead hang, you're trying to not do a bridle.
Trying to not make a bridle.
Yeah, got it. And what is that less structurally sound to have a bridle?
No, the more bridles I have, then the lower my trim ends up being.
Oh, because they have to come to
you
a point.
You have to triangulate to a point.
And you can't make them really tight and higher. They need to meet it.
They have to,
45
they,
degrees or something?
Well.
Depends.
Ideally. That's what
ideally.
You want.
Yeah. That's the most structurally sound. Yeah.
Right.
But every additional inch that he's able to get us of trim height means that we have more variety and more space to build all the different truss configurations.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
It's the ceiling to what you're able to accomplish
exactly.
creatively. Yeah,
if,
that makes a lot of sense.
If we have to cram this rig into a smaller room, then we end up limited in
the variations we can make.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, like it's difficult to scale on the NavVoice side. Is. So,
oh yeah, you can't just accordion it in. You have to rebuild all.
It would be wonderful if it worked that way, sure. But it doesn't.
Okay, so segueing from that, like, what are the safety concerns both in your normal job with hanging a light rig like this, but also with these moving trusses?
Sure. Well, I mean, safety concerns.
Like the software, will it say like, "Hey, don't drop that on the drummer"? Like, what are the limits of the system?
Well, on the NavVoice side, you know, not being able to crash it into the ground, they have soft limits.
Okay.
That, you know, won't let them drive it, you know, yeah. further than it knows where the floor is, yeah. or considerably higher than that.
Yeah. But there's got to be a, like, we're taking the rig down setting, right?
So when we take the rig down on a loadout, we'll fly the mother grid in a considerable amount of the way.
Got it.
And then from there, the nav hoists will then drop each truss down to a working height.
Sure.
Where we put the legs in and then set it on the ground and disconnect it. And
there's a guy at a nav hoist console. What do you call it? The software? The navigator.
Tate navigator.
Yeah, Tate navigator. Right. So that guy is like making sure he doesn't drop a truss through the floor.
Yeah, there's also two automation guys that work on deck, you know, closely with us because, you know, it's
yeah.
it's one team, one dream. You know, their stuff is attached to our stuff.
And they're here every
stuff.
Night. It's not like coming
to the... Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they have three people that operate the show every night, and one person is at the console actually operating the show and taking the cues. And then there are two guys either side of the stage spotting the rig. You know, because it's still constantly moving.
Just in case, yeah.
And
wow, you know. That's like a full team. And this is a part of the team that was never there before.
They were involved when we added the video screen last year,
yeah, okay.
because of the expansion mechanism that
sure.
made it grow and the lighting trusses that moved to reveal from behind it. So we had an automation team. They just weren't so busy during the show because there was basically one queue to run.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it only ever did one thing, really, as far as they were concerned.
Yeah, and now it's all the time.
Yes.
Sometimes right. throughout the whole set, almost. Yeah.
Yes.
I want to talk about the cable management specifically with the moving truss system. Because I was watching it yesterday, the way that the coils kind of unwrap at certain points, they
right.
get tacked on. Can you mm-hmm. explain that?
So they're on drop-down loops, essentially, mm-hmm. is what you would call them. So there's 50 feet of cable in between the mother grid and the actual truss.
Mm-hmm.
And that cable, as you said, gathers as it raises and expands as it drops. And the way that it does that is they're attached to chain sliders, which are made by Tate.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those cables has a sling with a carabiner wrapped around it, spaced mm-hmm. appropriately. And so we just clip the choker to the slider in a loop when it loads in. And then ideally, you know,
yeah.
it cooperates for 14 shows and goes up and down when it should.
I mean, has it been cooperating? Or does
absolutely.
It,
yeah. yeah, we haven't had a
because, like, what happens
a single
tangle?
Problem.
Like, if one of those comes around the truss or something?
It can't. So there's a standoff. There's a plastic standoff
uh-huh.
That's holding it above the length of the first loop. And each loop gets smaller
okay.
as it goes up by a couple inches.
Yeah.
And the way that we were able to do that is we made a story string. So I tied a piece of tie line to the top of the truss and then went all the way to the bottom, and then I, you know, made my first long loop, and then I made shorter loops, and where I put each choker, I marked on the piece of tie line
mm-hmm.
as well, and then we just did that 30 more times.
Wow.
With me and another guy just
yeah.
flying up in the air, taping these things on and clipping them, and now, you know, every day just install them, and ideally they work the way they should.
So you say every day. You're actually doing it every day.
Well,
here?
Every day that we load in, but we inspect
yeah.
them every day.
Yeah,
yeah
sure.
we fly everything down to a working height, and the automation guys look at their stuff, and we look at
so
our stuff.
So there's never a like, man, it was cool yesterday. We're just going to leave it. It's you,
no.
every day it gets treated. You
no.
don't load in every day here at MSG, but
yeah, we don't load in every day. But yeah, every morning you come in and you do a systems check,
yeah.
fire it all up, make sure it all yeah. looks right.
This is another question I wanted to ask about. So all the truss and lighting up there is pre-rigged. Can you explain what that is to people who don't know?
So the lights ride in the truss.
Yeah, so you put them on the truck, attach the truss, cabled and everything.
Correct.
Great.
Yeah, it would be a nightmare and nearly
a rig
impossible
this size,
if I
yeah.
you know, essentially had to you know, rebuild the rig from scratch.
I mean, that's what we
day.
Do at my level. You know, I've got 8 points and 8X4S.
Sure.
So we've got a couple looms. We throw them up there every day, but we build it every day. But
right.
So, like, what do you work on tours that aren't at that level that don't pre-rig, or is that pretty much if you're in a semi, it's pre-rig?
I mean, generally you are. I think the first year that we were out on Fish, the front truss wasn't
okay.
pre-rig, so Ben hung you know, a bunch of lights on the front truss from 20 by every day.
Okay.
You know, he's out there half the morning.
Yeah. Yep. Just a rig that size, how can you can't keep up with it, you know?
Sure, you know, and it takes what it takes. And, you know, if you're in amphitheaters, then your front truss is generally getting built down in the pit, which means it has to take the long way around or get forked around, but the fork's only available after you unstack some stuff on stage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all loading in and loading out is a fine dance of of resources, I guess.
Yeah, man.
And it's got to be streamlined to the point where it's easy to explain to the local stagehands bulk of the labor to get it built.
At a certain point, you know, the stagehands have to be your literal hands. You can't just put your hands on everything and do it. You know, I'm sure you could do any one of the things that you're doing faster, but you can't do all of them at the same time.
Sure. So, I mean, your crew chief is the reason that's the name of the job, right?
Right.
A lot of that is just managing local hands.
Right, but when we come into a new city and we have our local labor there, they've never seen this lighting rig before, right? So Terry and his guys have to
you know, they have to have the plan.
Yep. Yeah, so
you know, my guys also have to carry basically the whole plan. You know, it's, you know, we all have a task to accomplish.
Yeah, so you and your four guys all know the rig really, really well.
Sure.
And they're able to impart the plan to local crew chiefs and local hands.
I generally deal with the local head, and I'll get the guys in the morning. That's in quotes, by the way, get the guys. But the stage manager will put me in touch with the head. I'll say, you know, when I'm ready to have some help. And so I'll get, you know, like four guys. You know, we'll start some tasks, and then when they're ready, we'll get some more guys. And then by the end of it, almost everybody's a lighting guy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's how it is in my world, too. Like, you do monitors? Well, hanging lights right now.
Right.
You
know?
And there's a little bit of a time pressure to that, because they can't start bringing musical instruments on stage until all of Terry's stuff is...
Sure, I have to be on the ground. And this particular system, it's basically building two systems. You know, you can't bring the pods, as they were, even into the equation until you get the mother grid partly off the ground. So you have to build one, you know, move it out of the way, bring in the one underneath it. So you basically have to, you know, do it twice, ostensibly.
This concludes part two of my two-part episode with the Fish Lighting Team. I want to thank Chris Kuroda, Andrew Giffen, and Terry Smith so much for having me out. It was really an amazing day. I learned so much. I'm sure you guys all have too. Really, really once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I also want to thank Sandy Paul. Sandy is a great LD. He introduced me to Giff and Kuroda sometime last year, and that's kind of how this whole thing fell into place. And if you like the show, head on over to iTunes, subscribe, leave a little review. You'd be surprised how much that helps. It doesn't seem like it's a big deal, but every review helps. Also, there's the Patreon account, which I talked about at the beginning of the episode, patreon.com/thelightside. And, you know, come say hi. Hop over to the Discord channel if you've got questions. That's discord.lukestrattondesigns.com. You can bug me or any other LDs that are on there with all your questions and comments, post your own work and all that stuff. So, as always, thanks for listening.